Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and tonight, as always, we explore the evolution of consciousness and how it is making an impact on our culture and how we are evolving as a new race of beings, as people who are emerging into a greater awareness of ourselves and our connection to the earth. Tonight I have a guest who I really enjoyed last year when I interviewed him, Dennis William Hauck. He's one of the organizers and be speaking at the International Alchemy Conference coming up in September in Long Beach, and their website is alchemyconference.com. Welcome, Dennis. Thanks for being back on the show.
Hello, Alan. Thanks for having me.
Are you one of the organizers this year of the conference as well?
Yeah, I worked all year with the conference on the core team to find good speakers, and I actually founded the conference. This is our fourth annual conference.
Right. Who are some of the major speakers you're really happy about having this year?
We've got Montauk Chia back, and a Russian scientist, Corey Tov, and just a lot of people in different areas is what I'm really pleased about, that we're covering so many different aspects of alchemy, modern alchemy, traditional alchemy. So we have people like Robert Allen Bartlett, who's a practicing alchemist, and a wide range of practicing alchemists, Gabriel Maruni and others who are have been in the art for many, many years doing traditional alchemy, Russ House, a lot of famous people in that tradition. And we also have a lot of modern speakers who've taken the tradition into new areas.
Oh, yeah, Nassim Harmim. He's been a guest on the show. He's one of my favorite people. What a brilliant mind he is.
Mm-hmm, indeed, yes.
And Tim Wallace Murphy, what is he known for? I've heard his name.
He's he has an aspect of alchemy that is both technological and spiritual. So he's kind of combining old and new. He's one that really is bringing the traditions together.
Mm. And someone who also is very well known is going to be there is Kathleen McGowan. She's written the whole series on the Magdalene mysteries.
Yeah, well, and her lecture is going to be on alchemy and the connection to the mysteries. Alchemy is a mystery tradition. She's going to be a great speaker, too.
So that will be September 16th, 17th, and 18th of 2011 in Long Beach, California. I plan on being there and meeting you and doing some video interviews there on site. So
wonderful.
So let's talk about, sort of where we left off last year. I mean, that's still a hot listen to interview on my website. You were talking about sort of this age of copper we're entering into, or we're in, right?
And right. In alchemy, the progression through the what they call the planetary metals or the planetary aspects, archetypes, began with lead in the evolution of our particular galaxy at Saturn, and continued through tin. They look at it as a transmutation of each metal and the archetypal properties of those metals into a new metal, and that those are so ingrained in everything we do, every bit of consciousness that is in the universe and every bit of matter that is in the universe partakes of these archetypes. And we've come through the Iron Age, the age that is just coming to a close, of fist and power and the effort to control. And we're coming into a new age of copper, which is the conjunction in alchemy. It's actually the turning point in alchemy, where a species or a planet or an experiment takes on a new aspect and actually enters a higher level. So copper is all around us. Copper is definitely taking over the planet. Copper is the metal of communication, of love, of understanding, of wisdom. And that is coming from the viewpoint of the Iron Age, which was all about power, a very materialistic age. And copper requires an amelioration of spirituality and materiality to come into being. In other words, communication, intelligence, facts, information is just as important as anything in the material world. And that is becoming the new paradigm on the planet, and the copper age is unfolding before us.
Well, everything has copper wire in it. I mean, that's what all our communication devices are made from. So you're saying then each age is dominated by a metal that is also a sort of signature for the way people are thinking, the level of consciousness that people are at.
Absolutely. And it's you can look at it like Carl Jung did, who believed the same thing I'm talking about now, is that each age has its own metal, and that it he believed it formed through synchronicity, through the power of mind to meld with the archetypal reality of the super conscious state or the group mind, and that's what's guiding it. But I believe it's even deeper than that. I believe that this pattern is ingrained in everything and into all matter, that and we're matter, and we're energy too. So it's that combination between energy and matter, if you will, guided by light. You know, it's the old E equals MC squared idea, that is the universal formula, and it's true on many, many different levels. And it's expressed in alchemy, what the alchemists saw, in the metals coming forth through this natural process of individual, planetary, and social transmutation.
So just as a little history, we began with lead, ruled by Saturn. What time period was that? What age was that?
Mm-hmm. The Saturnic age. Saturn is the slowest moving planet. Its archetypal characteristics are power, and lethargy, not really caring about changing, not wanting to change. The leaden personality is set, convinced that there is no hope for change. And you see that dynamic, and sometimes in families where the father or the parents realize that they can't control the world, but they want to control their family. And that's a very Saturnic idea. Father Saturn, in fact, ate his children because he was threatened about them leaving. And it's also associated with time, the feeling of being under the control of time, and kind of a hopeless state, but still a very powerful state. And lead and Saturn are really the beginning and the end of this whole work, because lead changes into gold. And it does that through the secret fire that it contains. If you take lead and powder it up very, very fine, and you've got to do it in vacuum, as soon as it's exposed to air, it just bursts into flame. It, without igniting it or anything, it just carries the fire of its own transformation. And that idea is there with leaden people too. They have, although they don't want to change and they're satisfied with their life and they fight change, deep within them is a fire burning, and that's what they're trying to control is on the psychological level. And Saturn too is a planet. The ring around Saturn is because Saturn wanted to become a star, basically. It tried to draw to itself more and more matter, and if it would have reached a critical density, it would have become a star, and we would have had two suns in our solar system. So interesting metaphors that the alchemists saw in their chemical and metal mythology they developed.
Was that part of any historic period, the Saturnian times?
Yeah, this is the period when lead dominated the planet. The lead is the...
What year was that, though? What historic period?
We're looking about 10,000 to 5,000BC, and especially in China.
I see.
You see the lead age coming into being, and on Europe, too, wherever there were human beings, it dominated, and you know, there are still cultures still dominated by lead. It's not that the whole planet changes all at once. There will still be pieces of lead on the planet, you know, changing, just like there are pieces of lead within all of us that linger and are changing.
So there are seven ages due to the seven, well, what they call planets, and the seven metals, the seven major metals, right?
And you can continue looking at tin and how lead evolved into tin, and how Saturn gave birth to the Jupiterian concept, which is one of expansion. You know, Saturn's very contracting, very leaden, very heavy, whereas Jupiter's about expansion. It's a very airy, huge planet, and it's about growing and growth. So these two archetypes here at the beginning of creation, Saturn and Jupiter, are these two opposing forces of contraction and expansion, or you could call it soul and spirit too. Soul is very Saturnic in many ways because it wants to contain itself.
Right.
And those times when soul expresses itself, it is a contractive, introspective time. Jupiterian impulses are more like spirit. You know, they want to expand. We want to create and grow. And that's the Jupiterian personality, the Jupiterian archetype. So that's the time of expansion, the Roman Empire, the times of cultures that want to expand when tin dominated the culture with from cups to everything in their society. And yet tin is a beautiful metal, very shiny and hard to tarnish. It's very much like silver, but it's not. It's tinny. It doesn't have the holding ability. It even gets diseases and becomes corrupted over time. Although when you first see it, you think that it's a beautiful thing. So in psychology, and Carl Jung noted this, that Jupiterian people or Jovian people tend to be very social, very friendly. They tend to use people, though, and they tend to be not have deep relationships, just to have superficial relationships. And and that's true of the tin, the metal, and the Jupiter itself.
Well, we probably all have elements of everything in us.
Uh-huh.
But have we passed through the Golden Age and the Silver Age, or is that yet to come after the Copper Age?
That is yet to come in the unfolding of the alchemy of our galaxy and perhaps our universe. If we look at the stage when gold has yet to dominate the planet. In fact, gold is a very, very special gift from the universe. The gold that's on our planet Earth and in our solar system actually came from a single supernova hundreds of millions of years ago that shot gold particles into space and distributed them equally on the planet. So little pieces of gold are like seeds of gold are distributed amazingly, precisely, equally on our planet. And they group together because of, you know, geological faults like quartz veins that concentrate it and igneous rocks that cool and capture gold particles, and then erosion concentrates them in spots. But gold is very unusual in that aspect. For instance, tin is distributed on the planet, and Goethe discovered this, was the first scientist to discover this, Goethe, the German philosopher and scientist, that tin on our planet is actually distributed on the ecliptic from the planet Jupiter. If you draw a line from the center of the of Jupiter and it crosses the ecliptic of our planet, that's where the tin on our planet is actually distributed. Mm. And lead, too, tends to form on certain places on the planet that are closest to Saturn in that time when these continents were forming and stuff. So it's very interesting on how these things synchronize their characteristics of another.
But you say gold all came from one supernova? That's amazing. I haven't heard that before. And why is gold so valuable? In a way, it's another metal. Of course, it's beautiful. It doesn't tarnish. But what is the secret to gold?
The secret to gold is that, and again, this is hard for us to realize. You've got to go back into the more primitive mind when people were closer to nature, okay? And the metals, we take them for granted, but the metals, like nothing else, have transformed this planet and transformed our lives.
And civilization, you're saying. The discovery of metals was the biggest discovery civilization probably made on the planet.
Absolutely. The one thing that really changed us from animals into civilized beings with the possibility to develop wisdom and to make cultures more advanced. I mean, imagine a landscape that has just trees and just mountains and just streams and just sky, and you've got to fight for your survival. And then one day you're around a campfire or you're building a fire next to a wall, and all of a sudden this glistening material starts that you've never seen before, so artificial looking, which could be lead ore or mercury, cinnabar, that in a flame when you roast rocks, the metal comes out the cracks and just solidifies in the ashes of the fire. And imagine what that was like. And then to discover that there were more and more metals, that's why alchemy was such a secret, because it was about metallurgy in the beginning. And the relationships with the metals were magical, because that's the way people thought then. And in a deeper sense, the relationship with metals is magical, and because they carry the purest archetype of what the universe is about and how it is evolving. It's something we can see and feel. So the development of the metals and the discovery of the metals changed the planet. And gold was the ultimate metal, the perfected metal. The ancients and the alchemists believed that all the metals in the earth were slowly transforming into gold, because that was the final point of the perfection of evolution, if you will. And not just on the metallic level, the material level, but also on the psychological level, the spiritual level, the social level. Gold is that perfectly balanced state between materialism and spirituality, if you will, between masculine and feminine consciousness, between logic and intuition. Gold is wisdom, in other words. Gold is the possibility of wisdom, and it's really something that the fact that there is gold was so exciting to alchemists, because it meant that there was a possibility of perfection. Gold is absolutely inalterable. You cannot change it, no matter what you do to it. The gold we have today is the same gold that was in the pharaoh's tombs, and it's been recycled, and it's virtually indestructible. It's an amazing metal, and I really didn't realize that until I lived in New York for a while, and then I moved to get out of New York. I was in the publishing industry and didn't enjoy it too much, and I wanted to make a break, so I moved to the middle of the Nevada desert. In a little trailer, was pretty much living like a desert rat. I had no income. I had 3,000 books that weighted down one end of the trailer so that it was kind of tilted up about 2.5 feet in the air. And I couldn't have been happier. But there came a time when, and I was researching alchemy during those periods, but there came a time when I needed money, and I just happened to pick up a little paper at a gas station and saw that there was a opening for a project engineer at a gold mine nearby, and I kind of customized my resume and went in and got the job, and it was a good paying job, so it worked out just fine. But one day, I was asked to go down and inspect the face of the mine, which was about 2,000 feet underground in a vertical shaft elevator, and I went down, there was no one working. It was on a Sunday, and I was inspecting the area for a project I was going to be doing. And I walked into the face, and there was a light on the wall. And it was like entering the most sacred place you can imagine. It was totally quiet. There was in front of me was a wall of white, pure white quartz. Mm-hmm. And right in the middle of the wall was like a 8 to 10 inch shaft of gold that was going up towards the surface of the mind. It was, you know, thicker on the bottom and striving towards the light almost. It was a beautiful golden experience, because it had its own light. It's hard to explain being in the presence of gold 2,000 feet underground and seeing it raw like that. That day, that moment, I think, is when I really changed and changed my career, changed my goals, although I'd always been interested in alchemy and studied it and taken an apprenticeship of it. It was that day that I realized that it's time to bring this alchemy out into the public. It's time to bring it to the surface, because there's this beautiful secret process going on deep in matter, deep in our planet, deep in our souls, that we have to recognize. And the more I became enthused, the more I became inspired along those lines, the more people I associated with who had the same ideas, the more authors I found who shared the same ideas and had that same inspiration. So my life's about gold, and and it really is, because and I'm striving for gold, I'm striving for balance in everything I do. And I know socially that we are too, that every one of us, despite the frustrations of and the soul-killing activities of work and all the things that go wrong in this world, we all at some level have been children and have had that golden experience for some time, or we've experienced it at some time in our lives. And the process there of remembering and experiencing and understanding the gold and archetype is alchemy. It's taking, changing that leaden experience into a golden experience and realizing what our species can become. Not that we don't have to stay tied to leaden mentality, to a materialistic viewpoint. Science is leading us light itself, consciousness and science and understanding and wisdom, which is light, is leading us more towards the golden experience.
Well, I think that's our evolution. The way you talk about metals, I get a real sense of the spiritual qualities of these elements, of these solidified elements. And I mean, it's spiritual on one hand in the sense that they contain an essence of our very nature, and also the core experience of the physical universe as well. I mean, they're the grounding of the earth itself into form, and there's a personality or a movement that goes with each of these particular solid elements.
Absolutely. The metals, in fact, nearly everything around us is some compound of a metal with other materials. You know, all minerals have metals in it. There are many more metals than most people think. You know, calcium, sodium, potassium, they're all metals. And most things in the periodic table are metals. And
what makes something a metal?
It's the arrangement of the orbitals, but basically it's the characteristics of the lattice, or the atomic lattice that forms the element. It's basically, we still see the basic elements, hydrogen, helium, and it's like they were all built up from that. And then when you get towards the middle of the table around the element 80, which is mercury, you get a balance, and right there, there's, according to metaphysical alchemists, is where the periodic table, or the repeating cycle of transformation that you can see in the periodic table, that seven-step transformation is right there in the categories in the periodic table. You can see it evolve, and that is expressed basically and most fundamentally, or most obviously, in the seven metals.
Right.
In Mercury in particular.
So you said there's, in a way, that only a limited amount of gold that's on the planet that was originally created from the supernova, but wasn't the alchemist gold a goal, trying to create the gold out of the lead? I mean, make more gold than was already here?
Yeah, that the changing lead into gold,
yes.
Which is, for many alchemists, it was a literal occupation, and for most, it was a spiritual metaphor. In fact, you can delineate between those alchemists who pursued gold for riches and for power and for control, between those kind of alchemists, which were called puffers, because they spent their lives sitting in furnaces puffing on a bellows. You know, they believed that they could get a heat high enough to change lead into gold or to change any metal into gold. And they had this strictly materialistic viewpoint, and everything was materialistic. They didn't meditate in their work. They were just greedy. They were charlatans. They weren't above tricking kings into supporting them. And on the other hand, they were the philosophical alchemists, or the philosophers of nature, as they wanted to be called. And they were true philosophers, true in the sense of the word philosophia, which means the love of Sophia, which is the goddess of wisdom. They saw in the pattern of alchemy and the pattern of transformation opportunities to apply it to science, to mathematics, we're talking alchemists like Isaac Newton and Leibniz and many, many others who through the ages were interested in alchemy for spiritual and philosophical purposes. They were the first scientists who were searching for truth.
Well, so, I think it was both. In some cases, I think Newton was also after the material gold. I mean, I think he worked in the gold mint, the coin minting business.
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting point, Alan, because Newton was certainly interested in finding the philosopher's stone, which is kind of a golden state of matter that you can transform anything using that. So it could be a state of consciousness or an actual chemical. And he believed it was an actual chemical that had to do with antimony. But there are lots of people who believe that gold was transmuted through some type of means in alchemy, and that there's many museums, and I've seen them, where alchemical gold is present. And that Newton was made head of the mint is an amazing thing to happen to someone who was so involved in alchemy. I mean, the kings wanted gold to be manufactured in their treasury, and in fact, just before Newton, John Dee was given a license by Queen Elizabeth to make gold for the mint. Mm-hmm. And then everyone else, it was against the law to make gold in England because they felt it would upset the treasury. So there's a story there that hasn't been told, and there's more research to do, I think. But
John Dee did do some amazing things. I mean, that's a whole nother conversation that we have just about John Dee. But it seems like the true alchemists had a combination of both that desire. I mean, in a way, the movement of lead into gold was a spiritual practice where you had to change who you were and your state of consciousness in order for that to be reflected in the world around them. So in a way, it was a hermetic science. It was, the science of the thrice great. The Hermes Trismegistus was to conquer the body, the mind, and the spirit in the way of transforming all of that into a golden nature.
Right, that's right on. You're precisely right in that. There was this hermetic component, and that the philosophical alchemists weren't that interested in making gold. They were interested in making gold to see how it was done, to see how it would apply on the different levels on which they worked, the personal level and the spiritual level. I mean, it's not that hard to make gold. Physically, I mean, if you give me a pound of mercury, I'll make gold for you. If you take a 150,000 volt transformer, high amperage, there's even some neon sign transformers that'll work, and you plug it into that mercury and you let it run for 3 days, and you'll have gold. It bounces the orbitals around, and you get a microscopic amount of gold, but it can be transmuted. The idea of transmutation is a fact, and you could even do it in 23 hours in a nuclear reactor.
Right, but isn't that what the alchemists were after when they were burying it and firing it? I mean, all those stages of alchemy, they were doing the same thing, weren't they?
They were doing the same thing in the sense that they were working along physical lines, but there were the puffers who just worked solely along physical lines. And the other alchemists, the philosophical alchemists, wanted to change lead into gold to see how it was done, to get the quenching of their thirst for knowledge. The true alchemists worked simultaneously on all three levels at once. They worked on the physical level, and that includes the body, and they worked on the mental level, the psychology, and they worked on the spiritual level. And they didn't, and they believed that no change could be lasting and complete unless you worked on all three of those levels at once and accomplished the work on all three of those levels. So it was a combination of physical work in the laboratory, and it was a combination of concentration and meditation and purifying the environment. Every alchemical laboratory that was worth its salt had a oratorium where the alchemists would sit in a cell and meditate, and while the experiment was going outside in the Athanor, the furnace, or whatever type of experiment was going, it had a conscious aspect that's very reminiscent of some of the ideas in quantum physics about the observer effect and the nature of mind and its influence on an experiment. The alchemist always had, and in my own apprenticeship too, a great respect for the incubator, which is a place where after fermentation you put the material, the substance of the work, in a closed, hermetically sealed container that in which it grew. And during that phase, it was very, very sacred. And they hid the incubator underneath a table. They put a cloth over it because they only wanted their thoughts to be directed towards the incubator. If someone came in and just glanced at the incubator or just saw it and just had a thought about it, that ruined the experiment. That's how.
I didn't know that. Interesting. Yeah,
very sacred environment in the laboratory.
Huh. So this missing element that's in the Emerald Tablets that they say, you know, there's this whole talking about something, but they never tell you what the missing element is. What do you think they meant in the Emerald Tablets?
Oh, the Emerald Tablet is a succinct summary of this process, and I've done a lot of research on the Emerald Tablet. I've had expeditions to Libya and Egypt in search of the original Emerald Tablet, and it's an amazing document that summarizes the whole process. There's even a chemical formula embedded in the Emerald Tablet, which I'll be doing a workshop on and reviewing the stages of that physical experiment that uses seven arcanum. It's called the Arcanum Experiment, and it was performed in Alexandria based on the Emerald Tablet. So the Emerald Tablet is this summary that speaks of the one thing, and this one thing is, in alchemy, the first matter. It's something that is between mind and matter, that is between spirit and substance. The first matter you can look at as, well, it used to be called the ether in science, and it's the quantum foam from which arises reality. It's that level of reality that we know exists now, that we can exactly tell you where the universe, where the first matter is now. It's at the Planck dimension or the Planck gateway in quantum physics, which is, you know, precisely at 10 to the minus 33 centimeters and 10 to the minus 37th of a second in time. There's a space there. When you go beyond that space, you're into a place where there is no form, where everything is energy that comes into form through consciousness, through the projection of consciousness into it. And that is the one thing. That one thing, in other words, is the same for everything. That one thing became our television, became our bodies, became, according to the transformation of light that occurred in it through evolution or whatever guiding light is in the universe. The alchemist rarely spoke of God. They did speak of the one mind, the idea that consciousness is somehow behind universal evolution, that there is a goal. They really believe that. But they didn't believe it was a God that could be approached. Sometimes they called it the sun behind the sun. In other words, there's a greater light somewhere that's controlling our universe, or that's controlling the game here, if you will. And that, too, is becoming a modern scientific idea, too, which is mathematics and really what my background was. And it's something we don't need to get into, but Kurt Gödel actually proved And he actually called it the one thing and the one mind in his work, Mathematical Proofs, that there is something outside our universe, that we can never know this universe by studying it completely. He said that mathematics is not going to find the final truth. And he proved it. And a lot of mathematicians committed suicide. A lot of my friends dropped out of math. And it was quite an upsetting theorem for mathematicians. I mean, most people have never heard of it. But Gödel proved that there is a one mind that is outside our universe by using some very creative mathematical logic.
Would that be the mind of God, or there's other name, or the ultimate reality, I think mm-hmm. they call it in Buddhist literature.
It's that unknowable, unspeakable mind. And if you, as soon as you fashion a god or give it a name or a face, a religion, then you're not talking about the one mind anymore. You're talking about what the alchemists called mind the maker. That there are different kinds of gods, hundreds of different gods that participate in mind the maker. Demons or the demonic idea that there are angels and demons and things like that. That becomes part of duality. But the one mind is in one place and one place only, where there is no duality. There's no good or bad. There's no left or right. There's no nothing but the one.
That's where we're all ultimately going if we're on some kind of spiritual path, would you say?
I think that spirituality and those who practice spirituality, they have that experience of the one presence or the one mind, and they realize... as I have and other spiritual leaders, I think, around the planet and people who aren't spiritual leaders, just everyday people all around the planet realize and know in their gut that there is this one thing, one mind that they carry within them too. The thing is that we share in this one mind, that we have the light of consciousness too, and we can apply that in our lives.
Is gold somehow some kind of... interdimensional connection to that one thing, perhaps?
Yeah, there is the idea, especially in the Renaissance time, that that gold itself was could transmute. In other words, potable gold and eating gold and gold colloids and gold drinks of all kinds were part of spiritual development. And we see that today, that tradition continued today with people who take monatomic gold and ormes. The idea that gold can still work through us physically in our bodies to improve the mind.
I mean, but what do you think? Is there truth in that in your experience, or is it dogma?
I take gold colloid, which is potable gold, which is nano-sized particles of gold, and it's subtle, and it's. But I think over the years. That it does help my concentration, it does help mental things. It has very little effect on the body. Silver colloid and the lower metals have much more an effect on the body. So I think what I can tell you about my experience with drinking gold and becoming having edible gold in my system is that gold is this higher energy that's related to mind, the light of consciousness. Meditation. I think gold enhances meditation. I really do, but it's subtle, and I don't think that you're going to give gold colloid to someone who hasn't had a lot of meditative experience, and I don't think that they would notice a change. So, but I think there's more and more people who will. It's like homeopathic preparations versus allopathic. You know, homeopathics have just a minute atom, millions of a part per million of the metal that we want to transform or work with or cure disease with. But that's on a very spiritual level, and you have to be attuned to that, I think. Whereas allopathic medicine, which is our everyday pharmaceuticals, are very powerful, and they're gross and they're crude, but they knock away the bodily things and the physical things without the participation of mind. So right. you can go to the drugstore and get stuff that'll cure you. Right. But if you want to use a homeopathic or an alchemical tincture or something like that, you have to invest the mental part too, to make it work. So you're wasting your money on, I think, you know, personally, on tinctures and homeopathic preparations, unless you have intention behind it and know how to use them and know how to take them. And that's the same with gold and metal.
Well, I've been using gold, a colloidal gold, a gold alloy in an Edgar Cayce device called the Radiac, which is kind of a weak electrical current that happens when you put this device in cold water and then put another aspect of it in this colloidal gold, and you feel the subtle buzz of energy through the body. Do you know about that device that Edgar
Cayce? Yeah. That's a resonating device. In other words, it is putting out waves of energy that resonate with your own mental and spiritual energy too. And I think that's how it transformed. There's a lot of interesting devices that came out of the Cayce work. And also Rudolf Steiner had a lot of interesting devices similar to that that resonate with our energies. And after all, the bottom line is energy. Energy becomes matter, and our diseases come from bad energy. I think that a lot of people are beginning to realize that too. Mm-hmm. So energy can change, and energy is where the work is, and the perfect energy, or the most powerful energy, is the golden energy, or that golden vibration.
Right, because I do think it feeds our light body, our higher bodies, if they exist. I feel there's a field that the golden energy feeds. So, but let me ask you, because we're running out of time. I mean, it seems like you really have a complete understanding of the field of alchemy and of consciousness and of spirituality. I mean, what still is unanswered for you? Where are you looking now, and what do you want?
The part that I'm waiting for is I've tried to live my life, and other people have too, as a seed of gold, and I don't, you know, nobody is perfect, and you know, I get angry and I get upset and I cause traffic problems and all kinds of things like that, and I slip down into the human that we all are. But there is the potential of something else in us, and that potential is best served as a seed among other people. So that's why I'm out there, and that's why I write, and that's why I do apprenticeships and help people study alchemy and hold conferences and do radio interviews. It's just what I'm doing is coming through me. You know, we're raising the vibration of the planet, and I think with 2012 and all the ideas that changes are coming, and I think with politics and the absolutely disgusting way our leaders are behaving in this country and around the world, that is helping too. The positive energy, the golden seed helps transformation, but also that leaden, dark human energy, the hatred, the stupidity, the silliness, the stubbornness, all that helps too, because people get fed up. And that is the first step in alchemy. That's calcination. That's where the fire, the secret fire, arises in us. And the hope for transformation is that each and every one of us will get pissed off. We'll get fed up with our lives, with the social level of what's going on in this world, because each and every one of us know something better. And that part, when that happens, when people realize that there's more there than we're being given, than we're being told, that there's more there, and all we have to do is come together and do it and accept it and do the work and try to find out what's false and what's true. And follow our gut and our balance and our intuition, and not logic and not irrationality, not selfishness, and not giving ourselves away. So it's a complicated process, but I like the alchemy that we're going into.
That's the alchemical process. It is a little complicated, and it's a lot of waiting and burning away the garbage that no longer serves, the impure elements, and that is a metaphor for, I guess, where we are now. A lot of the impurities of our society are being exposed and burned away.
Exactly. They're becoming more obvious. And and people change that way. And that's the people who are just sitting there watching TV and they're not really aware that they're working in alchemy. But inside them, that secret fire, that knowledge is being released, and that's alchemy. It's silent alchemy.
Well, it's also alchemy in the sense that all of us yearn for the golden age. And it is something that I feel is possible.
I do too. I think that we're heading there. And I think that we're not guaranteed a place there, that we'll reach it. And if we don't, you know, some other species will, because it's a universal thing. It's not about humans. It's about the life force.
But what can people, what do you feel people can take away from the conference? I mean, what would you like them to take away? I mean, seeing all these speakers talk about different aspects of the alchemical tradition and new traditions, what would you like?
What I would like is the personal experience. And we, at the conference, we come together more as friends on the same path. And people can ask questions and get together with others. We try to make it different from most conferences, where you go there and you get inspired, whatever it is, you know, get rich or do better at work, whatever it is, you get inspired, and then you leave and it's gone. You know, most of us, by the time we get home, have lost all that inspiration from conferences and meetings. We know that we've learned a few things, but what we want is for people to catch fire, to start the fire of their own transformation in their lives, and to come back to these speakers and authors and resources. And it's just not our group, but it's all around the world. There's other groups. So when you go home from our conference, wherever you're at in the world, there'll be similar people. And that's what we're hoping for, that, again, that it spreads like seeds of gold.
Yeah, I mean, you're making alchemy not an ancient art, but a living art. And
exactly. We're transforming alchemy, the whole idea of alchemical transformation is becoming more and more aware, more and more a part of our society on lots of different areas, business and psychology and areas that the medieval alchemists would have never guessed there were applications.
But, I mean, just to sum up, can you just talk a little bit about the earth itself and the kind of multifaceted elements that this body contains and how they sort of work together to create this Gaia consciousness?
The whole planet is transforming too. So the idea of levels is very key to understanding alchemical transformation, that it occurs on all levels of the universe. So there is a planetary alchemy going on, and it's changing through time. And it's the planet itself is turning to gold, and that's what the alchemists would tell you. The huge iron core at the heart of our planet determines a lot of what happens on this planet. According to the alchemist, that big ball of molten iron at the heart of the planet causes our wars and causes our inability to reason and to realize wisdom. And so the effort of the life force on the planet is what transmutes the planet itself. Uh-huh. So we are a part of Gaia. It's just not Gaia. We don't serve Gaia. We transform Gaia through our presence.
We are Gaia in a way, too, you're saying. Our earth bodies are an extension, or is Gaia as much as the ground we walk on?
Absolutely. We are changing the iron core, the hard iron masculine warlike core of this planet to gold by our becoming golden.
So when do you think the golden age will arrive according to this historic calculation?
I think that it takes place in quantum leaps. I think that it could happen in 5 years. It could happen in 500 years, 5,000 years. Time itself is part of alchemy, certainly. But the goal will take place through time, and so I think it could happen if enough people came together and resonated. If enough consciousness came together and resonated on this planet, Spielberg did that movie about the robot kid who.
Oh yeah, artificial intelligence.
Yeah, artificial intelligence. They had a very good point there. Was that it doesn't necessarily have to be human consciousness that transformed the planet. It's consciousness itself. And if computers can become self-aware, then that's consciousness. And maybe we're here to evolve into computers. I mean, that's a popular theme in a lot of books now. So what I'm saying is we shouldn't have human hubris that we are the ones who, we're the alchemist, you know? We are right now. We are right now. We're the dominant consciousness on this planet. But that can change. Mm-hmm. And we've got to understand that through time, anything can happen.
Well, we might be the dominant conscious, but consciousness is the thing that's dominant. And
exactly. The one mind is dominant in the universe, and that's the pattern that we inherit as living things.
Right. So I'm going to end with this song called In the Fire by this band called Green Fire. But I did want to ask this whole idea about fire itself that is so, in a way, incomprehensible. I mean, I don't think anybody knows what fire is, and yet it is the essence of all transformation. So how would you talk about fire?
Fire is the agent of transformation, you know, on the planet and in the universe. It's the thing that perfects things. And the alchemists looked in fire in very specific ways. Fire reduces things to their essence and makes ashes. And in the ashes from a fire, you find the essence of the being, of the consciousness, and that it survives. So it's this idea that, in fact, that's where the name elixirs came from. It means literally from the ashes. So the ashes of our personality, the ashes of our life, the things that go wrong in our lives and that reduce us, that take away our ego and our illusions and our negative ideas and emotions and judgments and things like that. When we're reduced, we're at our best state. We're present 100%. And it may not be the euphoric, you know, I'm going forward, I'm going to conquer the world. I'm a winner, winner, winner. And it may just be that you're a little sad about it and that there's work to be done in that state that makes you real. And that in the ashes is where the fire does the best work. And I think it may take fire a long time to change a person, but it'll be in the ashes. It'll be in your suffering, kind of, that you find the gold.
And it's out of the ashes that the phoenix rose, or the resurrection of the being into a higher state of their own evolution. I mean, so yeah, that makes sense. So just to sum up, what can everyone take away just from knowing a little piece of what you're saying? How can they apply this to their life? Just saying, by looking at it all?
Yeah, and the first step is always calcination. It's always about fire. So really, look at the places where you're not comfortable in your life, and that's where the transformation will start, you know. If you're totally satisfied with your life, or if you're in a perfect world like a child believes, alchemy doesn't work. You have to be dissatisfied. You have to want change. So the idea is to find out what's true in your life, what's genuine in your life, and if you really look at it in an alchemical sense, it may not be comfortable. You may find relationships that are bad for you, habits, eating, what you're doing with your body and mind. And you start to see yourself, you know, you start to see your hidden faults, and that's where alchemy begins. So it's that first step's uncomfortable, but it's just necessary.
And by going through the fire, we can be assured that the transformation will definitely bring us to a higher state, but you have to go through the fire, for sure.
You have to go through the fire, and it's a hard step. Maybe it's easier to stay in an illusion and stay in an ego-centric state, but it'll go. It's the natural progression of time that things get destroyed. Solve et coagule is how the alchemists put it. Dissolve and coagulate. That's the cycle. We destruction and creation. That's the cycle of the universe.
Yeah, no, it's true. Well, thank you. Thank you for being on the call and putting on the conference. I've been talking to Dennis Houck, or do you use your middle name, Dennis William Houck?
Yeah, I have been. There's a couple other authors out there with the same name, but I don't really care.
Well, no, he's the founder of the International Alchemy Conference coming up in Long Beach, California, and the subtitle is Revealing the Secrets to an Extraordinary Life. It's online. You can get tickets online. It's an incredible lineup of speakers. If you go to www.alchemyconference.com, you could see the list of three-day speakers and the guest who I've been talking to. So thanks for being on the show here today.
Okay, thank you, Alan, and looking forward to seeing you at the conference.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I look forward to learning this ancient and modern science. So this has been New Realities. If you want to reach me, I'm at newrealities@earthlink.net. And if you want to hear the show again, it'll be online at the website www.newrealities.com, also on bbsradio.com. And thanks for listening. Here's In the Fire by Green Fire.
Feel the flame, feel the pain, get up again, go on.